Hello, everybody, and welcome back to No Killing Goblins. I'm Dragonus.
And I'm Oshi.
And we are here today to talk about Lyskor and Book 6 and Rashgar. Really, what I think about most when I think about this book is the Rashgar.
That was a horrible intro. I think that was a 4 out of 10.
Okay, I'm a little distracted. I like I said, I've been keeping up with the candidates tournament today, and there is a super important game, and I swear to God, Pragnananda keeps getting down to about a second before making his moves on a 30-second increment, and it's difficult for me to pay too much
Can
attention.
we get some
Like a
professionalism?
good Wandering Inn fan, I'm also a chess
Can we get some
fan.
professionalism in this house, please? Guys, we are here to
Let me
talk.
know if you find any.
We're gonna talk about we're, it's another podcast about Book 6. Oh God, even I said because you disrupted me. We're gonna be talking about Book 6 today, specifically the plot lines that all involve Lyskor. What happened in the General of Israel at Lyskor while poor Zell went off and had himself murdered.
Yeah.
So, before we get started with all that stuff, other than the fact that I'm eating a cheese sandwich or two cheese sandwiches right now, anything fun happened to you while we were away from recording? It's been a couple of weeks because let's just say we've had some reasons not to record.
Technical difficulties and sickness, and it all adds up. I had barbecue pork over bacon fried mixed greens today because I'm from the South and by God, we know how to eat, right?
Which is a perfect segue because I really want to talk about some music stuff.
Is it the sudden Taylor Swift albums?
Oh, no, I mean, yeah, it is a double album, isn't it? It's like 36 tracks. Yeah, Taylor Swift's
Yeah.
Dead Poets Society came out, and it's the second part is better than the first one, and there isn't enough lyricism for me to get over the fact that it's still like okay, not like super amazing, especially compared to like Taylor's usual stuff or to Folklore. I like music that has a story to it, and Folklore was better.
Yeah, but that. Okay, so here's the best way I can think of to put it. Taylor Swift, after she had her really bad at music era, came out the other end and said, "Wow, wait a second. These dumb motherfuckers will buy anything I do." And then she made Folklore because it was a chance for her to really dig in and make something different because she knows that the audience is just there at all times, really. And there's so much power in that, and it means that this album, yeah, it could have been a little better, but I still really fucking liked it.
I mean, it's still Taylor Swift, so her lyricism is there. It's just, I think there were two different producers, and there was a producer for the first half and another producer for the second half. And for whatever
Which
reason,
makes sense.
I just enjoyed the second half better. I can pull up the song list if we want to talk about stuff, but that's not really what I wanted to talk about, damn
Well,
it.
oh, damn it. Well, here's the problem. We will talk about it next because I have not listened to the album yet. I have been so busy.
Oh, okay. Then you'll understand what I mean. Listen to the if you have Spotify, listen to the full 31 track thing. You'll notice that there's like a point where you're going like, "Oh, this is cool. This is cool. This is cool." And then you're like, "Oh, what's this?" And it starts sort of like ramping, at least in my opinion, it started ramping up in quality, and there were more bangers near the end than there were at the beginning. I will not name Nate, the smallest man who ever lived. I was gonna say I don't want to name names, so I won't. But I think Florence was way, like Taylor did the best. She's not great with the whole like collaboration thing, but Florence was did a Florence and the Machine got a like a collab with her, and there was I think what is it called? How did it end? Which is like it was so good. I liked How Did It End. You'll see what I mean. But that's not really what I wanted to talk about. What I wanted to talk about is that yesterday, because of reasons, I've been staying up late a lot and occasionally doom scrolling. So I was doom scrolling through Instagram and laughing at all the comics I follow, and this thing popped up for a podcast called One Song. And it's this po the podcast has two hosts, surprise, surprise. And it's hosted by like their Diallo Riddle, who was on HBO Southside. Probably not who literally created it. He's also a DJ, and Blake Luxury Robin. I've never heard of him. He's apparently a big TikToker. And lots of people like him on TikTok. I actually did look it up for a second, but I'm not a huge TikTok person. But the two of them like discuss specific songs and talk a lot about things like interpolation and the source of it, the history of it, and cool things that happen when it comes to like they talked about Nirvana's "Smells Like a Teen Spirit." They had Guillermo from Scandal on their podcast, and they talked about the one Madonna song that he lists, like one of the Madonna songs, and they just went through stuff, said funny stories, talked about like the source of various melodies and cool stories, and it was fun to listen to. And then eventually it led me to this YouTuber. Like, I was listening to it and then Googling stuff that they were talking about, and I found this YouTuber called HT Hayes. Have you ever heard of him? You
No.
need to Google this guy. He was like doing different album reviews. I've been trying to listen to albums more rather than just like random music, because a lot of these folks are out here are like, oh, this music is so great, this music, and I can't say yes or no to it because I haven't listened to the album and I don't feel like I can make an opinion, an informed opinion, unless I listen to it and at least understand it a little bit. So when people say Olivia Rodrigo is the next coming of Muse, blah 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 blah, I've only listened to like half of Sour, which was her premiere thing, and I haven't even listened to her like second album yet. Guts, I think it's called. It was released last year. And until I do, I can't say that she's like super. I like one song of hers. It's not even the driver's license one. I think it's the one where she got like she sort of got caught. Anyway, Good For You. It's the Good For You one. Is that the one? Yeah, that's the good one.
I'm a big Olivia Rodrigo fan.
Like, I've only listened to four of her songs. I didn't even listen to the whole album. It just, I feel bad and I can't like say she's
I mean
amazing.
that's fair. Like it's like me with this Taylor thing. I like Taylor Swift as much as the next person who's not a diehard Swiftie. But I just haven't been able to find the time to listen to it. And I don't know. I might get into it at some point during work over the week. I might forget it entirely. But if we're talking about YouTubers we like,
Yeah, well, partly, but
finish yours, and then I want to talk about a new YouTuber I just found.
So the HT Hayes thing, the reason I'm mentioning it is because I've been, I've told you about this before. We had an entire discussion about it. I've been super obsessed with Beyonce lately because I finally, like with Cowboy Carter coming out, if you like the whole storyline of the way Cowboy Carter was supposed to be the first of her three-part trilogy, and that it all plays together, and the sheer craftsmanship of like putting all these things together and making it all. I've been digging into it and looking at the history and enjoying the music because I personally like country music. I know not everybody will like Cowboy Carter because of various like I don't know, they don't like Beyonce, they don't like country music, whatever bullshit. Not that they shouldn't give it a chance because as she has stated, it's not a country album, it's a fucking Beyonce album. And it's just like I watched this HT Hayes guy fully lose it as he listens to Cowboy Carter. He's a Southern guy. And I was fascinated by the things that sort of connected me to him. He is a full-on straight white guy with tattoos. He's a music producer. He's exactly what you would think, like has weed stuff nearby, guitars, is always got a cap on, has the usual t-shirt tattoos. Link and he looks like a music guy, and he knows about Drag Race, he likes One Piece, he talks about like the detailed musicology behind particular songs. Meanwhile, he's also full on crying after the first song from Cowboy Carter, and that's what I felt like when I listened to it, like the intro music to Cowboy Carter, the first track. American Requiem, and it's just I was there, and I don't know. I just realized that a lot of like things have changed, and I should be looking outward more because turns out there's a lot of people who know more things than me that I would enjoy listening to, and maybe I should stop like going to the same six places at the same time all the time.
Yeah. I remember when I was doing truck driving is when I had first started listening to a different YouTube music reviewer person, Todd in the Shadows, who's been around for fucking ever and has been adjacent to a bunch of other YouTubers I watched. I just apparently never noticed him. And that was really good, and I kind of liked it a lot as well because I was not huge into like a lot of pop stuff until I started listening to his stuff, and he got me thinking, oh yeah, wow, there actually is a lot of like really good pop out there.
I know. I was always surprised. Actually, listening to the One Song podcast, which, again, really great podcast. Take a listen to it. These are all short stuff, and they just literally talk about music, and these are full on like professional DJs breaking down the music a little bit. That I picked up so many like people to listen to. Like there is this musician. There's this TikTok song that was going around. I don't know if you rem or have heard it. You probably have at this point. And it was basically what was the name? It's by Pink Pantheress, and it's "Boy's a Liar." It had Ice Spice in it. Boy's a like that. Boy's a liar. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like I didn't know that. I thought it was just like one of those TikTok singles that. You know, gets big for a minute and then everybody forgets about it. But no, there was a full artist behind it named Pink Panthers, and she has two albums out. And I was listening to her albums, and she has a very particular like, she does music production and she produced both of her albums. It was actually nice to listen to, and I like you find stuff. There is new stuff that doesn't suck. Dear God, I thought that I was in a desert where nothing new would surprise me ever again. Turns out, not so much.
Yeah. Old age can be like that. We finally managed to get some wisdom into our
I
brains.
will say though, books still suck. It's been 2 months and I still haven't found a good book to read. I did download Richard Osman's next book in his series, the Thursday Mystery Club, Thursday Murder Club Mysteries, called "The Last Devil to Die." I'm supposed to read it. I haven't yet. I will. And I read Stephen Brust released a new book, Liarn. It's like the next one in his series. I think he's close to finishing his Vlad Tylto series, so he's very close to the last three books in the series, and it was impeccable. And I need to mention this to you, because in the this is another music thing. In the beginning of so the plot line is the main character is hiding out in a theater and they're putting on a musical. And Stephen Brust happens to be a folk singer and a big one at that. So you want to get what you want to guess what Stephen Brust did? He took a buttload of songs and he made filk versions of it, comedic filk versions of it, for and put one in every single chapter. Like the first song is Modern Major General, you know, the Pirates of Penzance thing. And
I am very familiar,
yeah,
yes.
like it is hilarious what he did with the music. He did a Mary Poppins, not a Mary Poppins cover. What was it? My Favorite Things from Sound of Music. He did one with like a bushel and a peck. Do you know Bushel and a Peck from Doris Day? But yeah,
Yes.
like
Yes, I'm aware of all of these things.
and then he did like the fifth dimension of the Age of Aquarius fully. Like all the lyrics fit, the melody fits, all of it fits, and it's story centric and it's fucking hilarious. And it's basically about an artist, a bunch of people putting on a musical and getting harassed by the authorities and some people getting killed because of it. It's like the story itself is already good, but he went to that one extra step and it was like, oh my God.
Oshii. There's just not good new books anymore, also Oshii. This book is amazing.
Well, new stuff. This is different. This is not
Is
new.
it not new?
I mean, like new series, new writers, new. The Stephen Briss.
I
This is
mean,
his 17th book in the series.
I get what you mean. But hear me out. There is cool new stuff out there. That's actually the YouTuber I wanted to talk about.
Go.
This guy, he's got like 8,000 subscribers. This video was like a Guitar Hero thing. It's got like, God, not even 100,000 views yet, I don't think. Actually, I just refreshed the page. It's cracked a little bit over 100,000.
Okay.
But it got dropped into my feed.
Show me.
And it's this guy, Club, who played and ranked every Guitar Hero game ever, beating every song on Expert. And I realize that sounds like it could be pretty dry, but it's not. Like, this is one of my favorite videos I think I've ever seen on YouTube. Like, I'm tempted to tell producer to stick a link to this in there. I'll put it in the chat. You should watch it. Everybody should watch it. It's so good.
There's something weird going on where every like Discord did something weird. I'm trying to like never mind. It's hiding things from me. Why is it hiding things from me?
Because you're in streamer mode.
How do I get the fuck out of streamer mode?
It's an option in the settings,
Okay.
but and like that's the cool thing, right? Like there is new stuff out there and new people trying to get through. And honestly, I think part of why maybe novels have been seeing a bit of like a dry spell in that sense is because the barrier for entry for somebody to turn around and self-publish and do the web serial thing and just put it up on Amazon is so low. And that's leading to a world where the people that are already in the production system, so to speak, are still there, and there are still new people coming in, but it's not the only way anymore. Everybody isn't beating down the door begging for entry anymore.
I can understand that, and here's my response to that. That just should mean that there should be more people learning and getting better at this stuff. The fact that they aren't is sad for me. Also, a lot of the like recent lists, like I follow reactor.com, which used to be Tor. Their fiction affliction thing. And I know it's curated lists. They obviously put their own shit in there. But I looked through their fantasy list and I got bored, look like by the way, with three sentences into a description of a book. Like, if it takes you more than three to four sentences to get me hooked on a fucking book, get the fuck out of my face.
Or maybe your standard's just too high.
My standards are not just too high. I had this discussion with Kylera. I don't know if you saw the whole conversation. I'm telling you, I know what I like, and I can tell when something is not going to be what I like. And that's because I've aged, and I've spent 20 years reading too much. And at this point in my life, I know when you're trying to fuck with me. I know. I see what you're doing. I see you using keywords like diverse and lush and luxurious and all that shit to mean that this has no substance but a lot of eye candy, so come read it. Fuck off.
Are you all right over there?
It's your turn to talk.
Yeah, I know. I was just, thinking a little bit about just everything you just said there. I don't know. I'll admit, I am perhaps not the person to argue with you on that subject because I just have not been reading a lot of novels or books anymore. I just web serials eat up a lot of that time and space for me. Web comics have become so like accessible and popular, and there's just so many good ones of those. Which one of my all-time favorites is getting an anime adaptation, Viral Hit, check it out. And then this new movie just dropped that I have been waiting for like a fucking year to make its way out of the festival circuit, and it was only airing in big cities, called Hundreds of Beavers. Do you like slapstick, Oshi?
Sometimes hundreds of beavers, that's the name of it.
Okay, how do you feel about a live-action black and white silent film about a man trapped in the wilderness having to
Remember what I
learn
said
from
about in two
scratch? Hold.
lines, if you can't get me, fuck off. No.
No, okay. You want two lines?
You've already lost me.
Stranded Canadian man learns how to punch giant beavers, live action Looney Tunes.
The live action Looney Tunes would have been enough. I'll watch it. I don't think I'll like it, but I'll watch it.
It's on Amazon. We can do a movie watch night. Are you free tomorrow? Have you ever laughed so hard you felt almost physically ill, Ushi?
Ushi. Second off,
I'm sorry, Oshi, sorry.
tomorrow's my day off. I'm gonna do like I've been doing Bridgerton days with some friends. So I'm gonna watch Bridgerton in the afternoon and then I'm free.
Yeah, because have you ever like laughed at something and it brought you so much humor into your soul that you actually felt physically ill from laughing so hard for so long?
There was that time someone like on Taskmaster, there was something on Taskmaster. I'm not gonna mention it.
Taskmaster will do it.
Yeah,
Yeah,
Taskmaster.
that was this
Yeah.
movie. That's what this movie did to me. It was a visual masterpiece. I have it. We can watch it. It's looking on Amazon Prime if you're
Okay,
down
we can
to.
watch tomorrow if you wanna chill. But are we at the, did we get reached the 21? Yeah, we reached the 21-minute mark, and you have to go in 20 minutes. So let's move on to the talky
Mean, I have
talk.
a little more. I've got probably closer to 30, but
Yeah,
yeah.
let's move on. Okay, starting over. So we don't have a good transition, so we're just gonna dive right into it. So today's episode's all about the storylines in book six that involve Lescure. Specifically, there's a couple involving Ullesome. There's developments for Ilvris, the arrival of the Red Fang Five, which was originally six, but immediate arrival reduced their number, and the arrival of the Silver Fangs and the changes in the Antinium through the perspective of Yellow Splatters and Belgrade.
Poor fucking Bugear, man. All of the everything that they went through, and literally right at the moment of salvation, he's the last person they lose before they meet Aaron and get go to the inn.
I mean, it's pirate, but the idea of
That's just.
anything.
It's just so tragic. And so I have been talking about this the whole time we've been recording the podcast. I'm really excited for this because the Red Fangs have almost all of my favorite characters in them that aren't in the Horns, right? Like, I am so hyped for these people. I love all of these characters. I'm so happy
Name
that they
them.
finally melded into the main plot.
Name them.
And,
Name the character, name the Red Fang Five for the people.
You have Head Scratcher, Short Hilt, Bad Arrow, Rabbit Eater, and Numtongue.
There we go. Yeah. So these are the five that end up at the inn. Now, they've been traveling for the better part of like a volume, I want to say. They've been through pretty severe pressure. They lost the flower girl in Esthelm. The whole like Torin tries to murder them with a death horde. Then the Silver Swords tried to murder them. All this stuff that happened, and then they don't even really get to salvation. They got lost again along the way, and then what they really did was reach the innkeeper that they were supposed to reach. And no one expected them to reach the innkeeper. They expected the Red Fang Five to
Especially not them.
Yeah, they fully thought they were going to be dead. And I do love, I mean, Bugear dies, but Erin, like, obviously, because Erin is Erin, she immediately insists on feeding them and convinces them to move into the basement of the inn, which causes some, like, internal friction. And I do like that Pirate starts to build this thread about compassion and tolerance, not just tolerance, but like the difference between forgiveness and tolerance, right? Mersha
Yeah.
is the vehicle here for that, I think.
The Mercia scene broke my heart because, God, that child has so many legitimate PTSDs around goblins. But Aaron's right. It wasn't those goblins. And it is so difficult and painful to move forward in a situation like that.
Yeah, and creating that distinction of, I'm gonna just use like human here as the placeholder, but pick whatever setup feels comfortable for you species wise. But there is a commonality whenever disasters happen, especially when it involves sudden death. You and it involves other people and other people causing that death, war and conflict and it's easy to dehumanize the other, quote unquote, that caused the issue. Suddenly, if you get a couple of features together and they're it was their fault. They're too tall. The tall men did it. The fat
They're
guys did it. The police did it. The fucking like gangsters all did it, but they all look a certain like it. It's easy to do
there are
that.
some tragic real life in the news examples right now of exactly that kind of thing
Let's,
too.
yeah,
It's always relevant,
yeah.
and it's a lesson about the cycle of violence here too. Because, God, Mercia is a perfectly competent child who is probably going to grow up to be somebody with a lot of levels under her, and could maybe even go out to be an adventurer. And by God, somebody with her backstory living her life without somebody like Aaron to kind of guide her off of that path and help her understand the nature of that cycle of violence and internalize it at this young age. Yeah, that's going to be a whole lot of dead goblin babies with bad PTSD, thinking about their dead parents murdered by that one white gnoll, making gnolls' lives miserable too. But Aaron just tries so hard here to break that up, and the Red Fangs help their case a lot when they're introduced to the story, literally having one of their close companions die fending off horror goat monsters from beyond fucking logic and reason.
And I think Hilera like pointed out that the goats apparently were something that Pirate wasn't expecting. Like they hadn't scripted it out, but apparently goats appear in their story whenever they want.
I mean, they're great. I love the eater goats. They're one of the more original monster concepts of this
I mean,
story.
it's goats and just the fear of their of the thing, but sure. I'll take it. Eater goats are fantastic. The storyline with the Red Fang Five and Goblin staying in Eren's Inn is the, I think the beginning of developing Eren's like bifurcation and like she's always had this where she protects certain people, especially goblins, but this is a more a step up. It's no longer someone visiting the inn or Rag coming around. It's she's hosting a group of goblins permanently, especially goblins with, they're hobgoblins. Are they hobgoblins at this point?
Yes, they are. They're all hobbs at
Yeah,
this
so
point.
they're hobgoblins who are explicitly considered dangers by Lescor, and it really does divide her away from most folks, and she has, and yet she's truly like enthused by their presence. And it took me a long time to sort of unpack why Aaron Solstice felt like their presence was so important to her. And it shouldn't have taken so long to understand it, but it's Aaron's trauma. Like she failed so many goblins, she killed so many goblins. Here is a chance for her to redeem herself. She can save these guys who don't know what's happening on, sorry, who don't know what's happening to them and have no purpose or anything like that. And she can like give them something and in turn assuage some of the deep guilt she feels for the like stuff she's done.
Yeah, I think that if I would add to that, there is something to be said for how Eren really comes alive when she can subsume her own personal issues and anxieties and, oh my God, I've been trapped in an isekai world issues, into helping other people. And by God, inviting five hobgoblins to your basement and putting everything you have into them is a great way to consume all of that time and energy.
That's all I
And
got.
also, I think there's all there's I think something also a little bit vindicating about it too, right? That these five hobs are really proof that she's not wrong, right? She meets them actively saving a bunch of drakes from eater goats. She brings them in, she feeds them, and they're nothing but nice to her. And they are skittish and nervous around everyone, but they're not hostile. And it's just such a direct, exact. I want to say like test case or proof of concept, but Erin doesn't quite think like that, except for when she does, because she's way more devious than she fucking looks. You know what I
I mean,
mean?
that's what pirates spent the last however many chapters developing the Red Fang Five, the Red Fang Five for. It's they were pirates' way of showcasing the kind of horrors that goblins go through, their development, their growth, and the choices that people can and how like the choices that people can make and how easily that definition between what's a person and what's not can be, and then you have that whole history that we've seen them go through, and now the reader knows all about it, and we are enthusiastic about the two pieces meeting and hoping for the best for both of them, and you're too distracted to notice that the presence of the Red Fang Five will cause problems, and then when they do cause problems, you have to like struggle with how can we reconcile the fact that there are people like Mercia who have legitimate qualms, and there are folk and our own need to see the Red Fang Five survive, thrive, and be something. I like the way this was developed. I think it was one of the larger and more important plot lines for Lescor in The General of Israel.
Yeah. And as much as I would love to spend the next half hour just talking about the Red Fangs, there are other things in Lescor going on to talk about too.
Connecting.
Like a couple of my other favorite characters,
Right.
Elos and Yellow Splatters.
Yeah, okay. Okay, we could get into Yalaz and Yellow Splatters if you'd like. I was actually going to connect back the Red Fang Five to another group or another person who might have a personal qualm against the presence of goblins. Ilvris.
Yeah,
Yeah.
well, Ilvris and
All of them.
God, no, literally, like the book is named after him. God
Zell.
damn it,
Zell Shivertail.
Zell.
Yeah.
Thank you. I kept wanting to say Shivertail, but I'm like, no, he has a first name too.
Well,
He is more than just a nice
I
tail.
mean, Zell at the time was probably more tolerant than Ilvris was, which is
Yeah.
surprising, but
He,
not really
he,
surprising.
I mean, he says it himself that, like, if Aaron's right, if Aaron can prove this, if she can change the status quo, he's all about it. The world can be a better
That's
place.
what he
But
that Oh my
he's seen
God.
too much. It's been too much for him.
Yeah, and he steps away from the internet as a result. But here's the thing, the very fact that he can say that he can have hope. God damn, Zell was a hero.
Yeah, he was the hero that the Drakes need. And oh God, some of the most recent Drake chapters in Volume 9, I don't want to get into spoilers, but Zell really was the person that those Drakes fucking needed.
And as usual, they pushed him away and murdered him in the end. Ilvris is like Ilvris's development as a character across this book is like it very interesting because it dovetails into Eren's like fairy fire drink and its uses and how it like forced Ilvris to face the fact that he's grieving. The honest reason why he's in Lescor isn't even the goblins, isn't Zell Shivertail, it's none of that. It's because he can't go back home and face the fact that he lost Paris. And
Yeah.
like when that bit gets unpacked, I mean it was there, but we never really knew their relationship in a more like explicit way. Pirate was far more careful about like introducing that level of romantic entanglement in the earlier volumes. They got less precious about it later. But yeah, for that one, it was definitely, it explained a lot of Ilvers' behavior far better than anything
Yeah.
else did.
And it was this great moment to really be able to watch this character reveal that he's like an ogre. He's got layers. He is not this blustery asshole, to his core. He's got like this rich internal life, and this, by the standards of where he's from, very progressive romance with Paris, who is of a lower social status and has some other stuff going on too, that, means it's not the normal thing you would expect from his character archetype of noble McBlustery nobleman.
And the best part about
Also,
it is that the power dynamics between the two of them, being he's the, like, he was one of the big generals and lords and all that, and somehow he manages not to, like, interfere with the command structure in any way so that she's actually independent of him. And the impression I got was that Paris was, despite her quote unquote lower standing, was probably more even with him, more than formidable enough to match him and
yeah,
overmatch him.
we only really get the scene in the Fairy Flowers where they talk to get a real grasp of their dynamic, but it was a relationship of genuine respect between each other. And they were really truly equals, even if in the command structure they specifically weren't. And
What?
I also like that we begin to get a grasp on the idea that we met this guy getting his ass kicked, right? He, up until sort of this point, I always kind of had this feeling that he was just kind of a tag along and that he was, that big of a deal. But then you kind of start to realize, oh, no, wait, it's just everybody gets their ass kicked by Ilvers. This guy definitely has it. He's got the items, he's got the training, he's got the political
He's
pull.
Golden Boy.
He's no Zell Shivertail, but who is?
I mean, he's Golden Boy. This is like, that was what I thought was his original character. He was another Ryoka where everything, like, was hand. Oh, God, I'm gonna sound like such a dickweed when I say this, but everything was handed to him and he just succeeded and all this stuff. And he was like, I'm gonna be great. And then he finally had to meet reality where there wasn't anyone to hold his hand and he fucking lost a bunch of times. And he was crying about it. Turns out, not so much. He actually had a real reason to cry about it.
Yeah, and the more we learn about where he's from and Salazar, the more you realize that there's no free lunch in Salazar, even if you are a member of the nobility. It's cutthroat over there. It's very much more corporate than it is a traditional noble structure.
Yeah,
It's a
let's not.
totally different dynamic.
Let's not delve too deep into Salazar since there isn't as much detail yet.
Yeah, not super smart. I just like, I'm just, he's not sitting on a free
Yeah.
ride. And also it's interesting to see that the parts of him that are in fact just pure blustery asshole soften over this book, and you can see sort of this arc of him growing as a person and being less racist.
Not, I mean, that's the barometer that people use, and that's what Pirate uses as the, like, surface level thing that readers should be able to tag into. But you have to look at the inner, like, growth to Ilvris. It's less about not being racist than about confronting the limits of the world that he's been taught, of like how things function. It's what all, like, it's that period in your life where you pass your mid-20s or something, and you start recognizing that a lot of the rules that you're supposed to follow, they're kind of bullshit, and nobody really follows them. They just say that you're supposed to, and then they lie to you later because they figured out a way to, like, project success and tell you that their success became because of those rules. Nope. No, the marriage that you think is so wonderful didn't quite happen the way that they talk about. There was cheating, there were things that happened, but they figured it out and they're happy and they're married. They're just not going to tell you about the bad shit because why do you get to know? You only get to know about the surface level stuff. And Ilbris is very much facing the reality of the surface level is no longer there. His successes are no longer guaranteed. Instead, he's seeing the cost of the choices to, like, the, I think the best one I have, and this is my interpretation of it, so please don't take this as gospel of any kind, but Ilvris is looking around at one of the failures of Drake diplomacy, or Drake policy, let's call it. He's looking at around at a city that is filled with children, old people, and Nalls, from his perspective, because it's Drakes that are the only things that matter, and they are there to die to a bunch of Antinium so that they can start another war.
Yeah.
And he's not that stupid. He's figured it out, and he's looking around and looking at the way they built a life, and they're struggling, and they're continuing, and they're, and Aaron is challenging his perspectives, and he's look just that, and the fact that everyone around him is growing despite all of the pressures that Drake Society has put on them while helping them not at all, teaches him within moments that, like, it's not something explicit, it's something that you absorb by looking around you, that people do not require those kind of pieces, those kind of structures that he's been told all his life are necessary for, you know, survival and growth and success.
Yeah. Especially with what's going on with the Antinium.
Oh my,
like,
god,
contact
yes.
Theory is actively at play over there, even if it was a struggle, because by god, the Antinium try so hard to try and make their people into individuals, but all they do is murder all of them instead. And now that that cycle has been disrupted, at least, I don't know if I'd call it broken, there's still a lot of, like, growing to do, but now they can finally start growing together as a people, the Drakes and the Antinium and the Gnolls and the humans, right?
I think so, yeah. And speaking of the Antinium, let's push forward into the yellow splatter if you wanted to talk about it. Yep.
Oh, this was such a heartbreaking example of kind of exactly what I'm talking about. Because yellow splatters and Pawn and a lot of these individuals can see and they understand, right? They know that they were people before they were people, so to speak. They see every day, by the thousands, their brothers and sisters being sent into this endless, painful meat grinder. And Yellow Splatters is just so desperate to keep everyone alive, but he's losing sight of what it is to be alive and what's worth living for. And
it's the coping mechanism. Like,
it's all the fucking Queen's fault.
No, okay, fine.
No, I want to. It is so obvious to everybody but the Queen and Kilbekich that what's going on here is heinous.
Here's the thing. But here's what I want to reframe in this. Antinium know this is heinous. I think Kilbekich and the Queen know this is heinous, but to them, it's worth it, because the heinousness of what they're doing, of sacrificing all the Antinium, it's what they've been doing since they got to Israel.
No. I don't mean that so much specifically. Because, yeah, they realize that that is terribly wasteful. But at the end of the day, they're so trapped and caught up in their vision of what it is to be Antinium. Because at a biological level, the connection that they all have and all is... I don't want to get too deep into spoilers on this. But this chapter is, I think, the first real look into the realization that they don't get it. And what I think is heinous here is that it's right before their eyes, but they don't see it. That these are people that they are sending and not just workers.
Okay, hang on a second. There's another aspect of this that needs to be clarified. To them, consciousness and personhood are completely like defined in a very specific manner. And without that personhood, without the consciousness on the level of like pawn, they it's hard for them to even, excuse me, to recognize it. But I don't even want to talk about that. Well, I want to focus in on what Yellow Splatters and eventually what we learn Belgrade is doing, is that this is the next step in the evolution of the Antinium story. We've had them grow into their individual personhoods. We've had them grow into how to express their individuality and how to express their personhood, and then how that can lead them to making choices and developing. Now that personhood is looking at is how do you deal with the existence that you are put into, the outside world's pressures on you. So now you know you're a person. Now you know these are things you like. Now you know these are things you want. But what do you do with the fact that you also exist in a brutal world that murders and kills and people will die? How do you deal with death? And Aaron does not have a good way of good answer for this. And each of the Antinium that we like interact with, especially Yellow Splatters here, have to find a way to cope with death. Death as a concept, death as a reality, death as a meaningful piece of existence. Pawn's finding his way through faith, but one of the ways that how do you make death worthwhile? How do you make the losses that you take worthwhile? Yellow Splatters fully goes insane and is very close to going like mad, trying to find a way to save everybody because he thinks that's his purpose. That's how he will deal and cope with death. Ultimately, what snaps him out of it is because it's thanks to someone like Belgrade. So Belgrade is not really the it is part of the he was part of the chess club, but he's not seen as the most creative of the chess club. He didn't like he's not Anand, he's not Pawn, he's not like super creative. He's very obsessed with traps and he likes to do things in a very particular way. He's not Bird, certainly. But he has his own, but it's easy to dismiss him in that moment and just see that he just sits in one place and he's building something. What they discover very quickly is that the practical result of all of his sitting around is that he creates a kill box. His solution to dealing with the death is recognizing that everybody's gonna die, but I'm a strategist. My job is to make it cost as few lives as possible. I have the power to do that. I will find a way to do that, and I will not go mad because if I die, there won't be someone doing this. He figures out that there is worth in surviving and worth in figuring and struggling on to find solutions to mitigate these problems, to find ways around to make the deaths worthwhile. And that is revelatory for Yellow Splatters because he never had anyone, like the Antinium typically don't have anyone to guide them, but now they do. They have the chess club. And they have all these other individuals, and they can lean on each other. And I love the whole sequence, the way Pirate built it. They made it very much a show story rather than a tell story, and I appreciate it a lot.
Yeah, no, it's a great moment. And I also love the way that the Belgrade Anand dynamic is there, where Anand is this very talented, very sort of intuitive player and intuitive strategist, whereas Belgrade has a very firm grasp of the basics that he's building on. And you see when Erin says she thinks Belgrade will have a much higher ceiling as a chess player than Anand, in this moment with the kill box, where all of this strategy has been building on this very solid long-term defense that, yes, they had to go through a really terrible meat grinder, but the pressure is off in a way it really hasn't been almost since the Hive was built now. Also, this is why it's considered generally important that your high-ranking non-commissioned officers also have a good idea of the strategic overview of the theater and not leave them in the dark.
Yes.
Because if they had said to Yellow Splatters, "Hey, We're working on a long-term plan here to build these defenses. This is our, campaign goal, so to speak. That could have also really cut a lot of this off at the pass, but that also would have reduced conflict. Conflict is needed to drive the story. And it's a great example of how, for all they have levels and for all they have talent, none of these people have any fucking clue how actual organization in a military of people that aren't linked at the brain works. And I think that's a cool little detail.
Yes, I think so too. And I really did enjoy the interplay for the Antinium here. I think it really developed both the Antinium as a group and the individuals as a group as well. And it showed the limitations of folks like, sorry, it showed Eren's own limitations, right? Eren couldn't resolve their problems. They had to find their own way. And it showed how the dynamic could play out in the future. It's not all about Eren magically solving problems for them. She can be an inspiration, but it's up to them to find their own path. Speaking of finding your own path, Yla shows up with his hard head and silver sword and his elfin team member and his dwarven team member to the inn. Apparently,
Very classic
Eren.
adventuring
Yeah.
party. The only thing they're missing is a halfling rogue.
Which, oh my god, if only halflings existed in this world. But do you notice the pirate killed all the short people?
Yes.
I mean, it had to be said. Pirate killed all the short people.
Yeah.
Yalos shows up at the inn, Eren hits him with the cake, and because he's trying to, like, convince Yvonne to go home. And that entire storyline is so, I don't know how to describe it, but it's like,
I
oh,
do.
go ahead, go, you go for it.
This is a classic story archetype, the two classic archetypes in Ilos and Yvlon, where protective older brother is going to his younger sister and trying to be protective towards her, convince her to give up dangerous things she's trying to do, in this case adventuring, and she stubbornly refuses because she, is better than he thinks she is, and it's a very standard sort of story. And we are primed especially to view it that way because we've lived with the Horns. We've seen their struggles. We are primed to like them.
That
And primed really especially to see what a badass Yvonne can be. But I think that there is a neat little twist in this, which is that quite frankly, he's right. Yvonne's arms don't work anymore.
Well, it's only
And
one arm, I think. Wait, no, you're right.
no, it's both.
It's both arm, you're right.
Yeah, like she swings her sword too hard and they break. And I realize that ultimately that is just another challenge for her to overcome and that she's an adventurer and it's her right to continue throwing herself into that meat grinder. But I have more sympathy for Ilaus than I think you do or a lot of other readers do, because I think Pirate did something kind of clever with taking that classic archetype and then throwing in a big, but he might actually be right
You're
in this
wrong.
case.
No. That's the thing. That's what I was trying to be like. It's hard to describe because this storyline is not about brother sister. It's about annoyingly correct asshole and self-worth and self and like faith in yourself. There is always going to be that one person who is right, who gets to always be right in your life. Who gets to say the right thing and do the right thing and always knows the correct thing to do and is always there to rescue you? You hate that fucker. That fucker is why you are out here doing the things you do, because that fucker is the reason that you cannot go home again, because you're gonna be the fuck up and they're gonna be the cool guy. And that is what I was trying to articulate, is that Yvonne here isn't just, she's suicidal, clearly. She's clearly fucked up, but she's also in the right
Stubborn beyond
place.
all belief.
Yeah, but she's clearly also in the right place to sort of, she's trying to deal with her shit. Maybe not in the healthiest way, but honestly, the Horns are probably the only people who will, like, who she will open up to enough who understand.
She has found such a healthy, supportive group of people to, be with in this situation and moment.
And that's exactly what I like. You've lost. Sorry, Yalaz will not care about, because to him the correct thing to do is to go home, heal up, and then come back out. I mean, what does it matter if the healing up takes 30 years? And as far as
Or
he's concerned, that's all that matters. Even though Yalaz is probably he's literally walking around as a gold rank adventurer and is constantly doing the right thing by like challenging authorities and protecting people and killing monsters. Meanwhile, he's demanding that his sister go home. Like, the cognitive dissonance there is pretty ex like extensive for me. He knows how much like a good support system means, like having a good team means, especially because he is a gold rank adventurer with the two of them. With his team, with the Silver Killer swords.
It is hard to immediately look at the horns and recognize that as a healthy system, though, because so especially given the fact that, he's not got a lot of news about what's going on in her life. He hears her entire party has been wiped out and that she is, borderline comatose and badly hurt. So he rushes down to see her, takes a detour to Essilm, which I think that's actually a really important detail that we met him there, because we get an honest look at his character. That when a goblin horde had every chance of killing him and wiping out this entire town, he stayed to defend them. And that's a great way of Pirate showing us that deep down he is somebody who's trying to, do the right thing and be good to people, which is an important thing in this because he could really come across as not if the balance is slightly off in this situation. And he arrives to find out that she has not only gone out adventuring again, gone to Albez, destroyed her arms, found a huge hoard of loot, and is now adventuring with an Antinium, a necromancer, and
Syria.
Saria. And now he's like, yeah, this is supposed to be your healthy support system. We're your family. We love you. Our family life is happy and perfect, and nothing will is ever wrong with it, he says. Please come home and get better. And oh God, the poor guy is just like a giant fucking golden retriever. But he's the golden retriever that keeps trying to walk off with your fucking shoe or bring you a dead animal you don't want. You get he's trying to be helpful, but
He
please let him
always
know.
picks the least helpful path. Yeah. But that sums up most of the dynamic between the two of them, and it also sets up the horns for something big that goes down in this book as well. And this dovetails into Ullesome, the other person who objects to the presence of the goblins and starts maybe not hanging out at the inn as much anymore, because Ullesome also starts talking to people about the particular not goblin, sorry, not gnolls that he encounters in the dungeon. And we get a huge lore dump about the Roshgar, their connection to the gnolls, the fact that the gnolls were once, and whether by force or choice, an underground species, and that the Roshgar arrived there, and that they are like essentially what.
It was so when dragons were sort of at their most ascendant and more or less were enslaving entire continents and doing whatever it is they did to make the drakes, the gnolls just said, fuck it, we'll go underground, right? And the Rask'gar are apparently the result of staying underground and are different enough that they're now monsters and don't level anymore and are also kind of werewolves or something. That's really weird.
There's a lot of hints and legendary stuff I didn't quite absorb in this book. And Ollison's investigation into the dungeon attack from book one and volume one, he eventually figures out, like, he finds the place where the horns were killed, and eventually, like, his investigation leads him to the to realization that there wasn't a minotaur skeleton anywhere. And he and Pisces delve into the dungeon and find a hidden burial chamber with evidence that someone went through from above. And Pisces tells his team that Calruse is alive. Now, this is pretty much one of the most biggest revelations because Calruse was one of the centers of the Horn. He named the fucking team Horns of Hamoret.
He was such a central character to begin with.
Yeah.
His apparent death at the end of Volume 1 is one of the things that really shook me, because he felt like this character who was going to be around a while or die suddenly, right? Like, there's always that feel with a character like him, but I didn't really expect it, because a lot of other stories that are in, like, this isekai web serial genre don't hit that hard. And Aaron said, and Pirate Abba said, "Oh yes, I do hit that hard," and then gave us the right fucking hook, and then gave the horns the left hook.
Yeah, and the book basically wraps around the point where the horns are ready to go and look for Calruse. Now, this could go well or this could go badly. This could be another situation like with Eren's delve into the dungeon to recover Syria and Awesome, or it could be another disaster and something horrible could happen. So, I mean, it's a dungeon, so we pr assume something horrible will happen. And that really sums up all of the plot lines and storylines that are happening. And I really don't have a comment on the fact that they discovered Calruse's guy. I mean, it's super exciting. I want them to find it. I want them to get onto it. But it was more like it was a lot of lore dump rather than something I considered important outside of, yeah, it's gonna happen, right? I'm trying to wrap this up. Give me a transition,
Yeah,
goddammit.
sorry. I had an ADHD moment. I completely just lost about 30 seconds of my life.
Look, we're trying to wrap this up. So we gotta wrap this up.
Yeah. Let's get it wrapped up. So we'll tie a neat bow on it. Thank you for listening to No Killing Goblins.
See you, everybody.
See ya.
You've been listening to No Killing Goblins. The music on No Killing Goblins was composed by System Glitch. They can be found at youtube.com/systemglitch. You can get in touch with us via our Twitter at No Killing Goblin or email us at nokillinggoblins with an S at gmail.com.